Over it and formed a solid mass in its mouth and nose, blocking air from its lungs, causing the cow's eyes to pop out as it tried to bellow but could not do so. Tobias finally jumped to his feet, grabbed the horse and mounted. The horse spun around and around, snorting, trying to force the obstruction from its nose, then it gained control of itself and ran blindly. Emma and Pearlie May were frozen with fear as they looked out over the marsh and watched the cows running wildly in circles, jumping and falling, repeating the frenzied cycle again and again. Emma saw Tobias go down and become engulfed in blackness. She screamed at Frog, "What's happening out there? What is it?" Frog slapped his arms and legs, and then he said, "It's skeeters, Miss Emma. Solid skeeters. We got to leave here right away. Run for the prairie. Go as fast as you can. I'll bring the horses and the oxen." Zek pounded his boots into Ishmael's side, forcing him to run through the swarming mass as swiftly as possible, feeling mosquitoes pound into his face like rain. He could not see ahead and only hoped he was heading in the direction of the prairie. Skillet stopped briefly and looked back at the spot where Tobias went down, seeing nothing. He scooped a handful of the humming bodies from his left arm, crushed them, and released them, and the bloody pulp poured downward like wild honey. His horse stumbled, but didn't go down. Then he galloped full speed to the east. Pearlie May fell constantly, her short, overweight body crashing into the bushes, and each time she could hear Emma scream, "Get up and run, Pearlie May! You have to!" The mosquitoes followed them 2 miles into the prairie until a brisk east wind blew them back toward the marsh. No one was together except Emma and Pearlie May, and their bodies were stinging too badly for them to even wonder about the others. They sat on the ground, rubbing themselves, scratching the welts, and making them itch even worse. Emma's eyes were almost swollen shut when she heard Tobias's voice above her. "Emma, are you all right? Have you seen any of the others?" He then sat with her, as everyone gradually came together, mutually miserable, their bodies angry red, the horses wild-eyed and still bucking but alive. All of them were dazed, and they huddled together silently until Tobias finally said, "Don't nobody go back there. We'll stay the night here, then I'll go in the morning and see if it's safe." "What about food?" Emma asked. "We'll do without." Zek climbed down from his horse and retched violently. Emma looked to him and said, "I'm sorry, Zek, there's nothing I can do to help you." "It ain't nothing, Mama," Zek said. "I'll be fine in a few minutes. I just got a belly full of skeeters and they ain't sitting well. I must have swallowed a gallon of them." "Don't worry none about vittles, Miss Emma," Frog said. "I couldn't work my jaws even for soup. Feels like every bone in my body is broken on fire." "The cows," Tobias said, scratching continuously. "Ain't no way they could run away from it as fast as the horses. And the horses almost didn't make it. I purely hate to see what's happened to them." "Maybe they got away," Skillet said. "But if they did, they'll be scattered all over hell and back. We'll have to start the roundup all over again." Tobias went back to the wagon alone at daybreak, taking each step apprehensively, dreading what he might find. When he reached the marsh, he saw that he no longer had a herd as such. Cows were scattered across the marsh as far as he could see, and there were many lifeless forms. Mosquitoes were still there, but not in mass as the day before. He returned to the prairie and led the others back. Then the men rode into the basin while Emma and Pearlie May prepared food. They counted 73 dead cows, and there were also bodies of rabbits, raccoons, and foxes. The swift deer seemed to have escaped the death cloud. Tobias looked sadly at the carnage, and then he said, "It don't seem to be no end to the pestilence this land can bring. Sometimes I think the Lord is warning us to go away." "We've been through worse than this," Skillet said, "and come out of it on our feet, and I don't think the Lord would turn skeeters loose on a bunch of poor cows. It must have been the devil instead." "Somebody did. And the book says everything is the work of the Lord. If it is, I hope he gets done soon with punishing us. I don't even know what we'd done to make him so mad."
"I don't either," Skillet said. "But I knows one thing. The Lord ain't going to help us round up the cows. We'll have to see to it ourselves."
Tobias looked up and watched the flights of buzzards that already circled the marsh. He said, "Soon as the sun gets to boring down real good, this whole place is going to smell pure awful. We better work fast and get away from here as quick as we can. It took them 2 days to bring the herd together again. Some of the cows had run as far as 5 miles, and all of them remained spooked and jittery. The loss of blood also made them sluggish, and some had mouths swollen so badly they couldn't eat. When they crossed the river and headed away from the salt marsh, the path for 3 miles was littered with the bloodless bodies of small animals. Buzzards were everywhere, flapping off in protest as the cows passed, then returning immediately. Tobias knew it would take time and grass for the cows to regain their strength, so they let them wander slowly. The rain caused the prairie grass to come back to life and flourish, and they found good grazing. Day by day they drifted across the land lazily, like a summer cloud. And soon the welts and the memories faded away. Chapter 20. The two riders first appeared as black specks on the horizon. They were moving north, and then they turned west toward the herd. They rode marsh tackies like Ishmael, but used no saddles. Skillet was on the left flank of the herd, and they reached him first. Both of them were boys, ages 15 and 17, and were Seminoles. Each carried a lancewood spear. One of them said, "We are looking for a man named Tobias McIvey. Could this be his herd?"
"You found him," Skillet said, wondering why they would be out on the vast prairie on such a search. "He's a man right over yonder, just in front of the wagon. How long you boys been looking for him?"
"We went first to his hammock," the older boy said, "and no one was there. Since then we have been riding for 2 weeks. We thought he would be somewhere grazing a herd."
"You just lucky," Skillet said. "This is a mighty big place. You could have rode them horses till winter and not found us. How come you looking for him?"
"We were sent by my grandfather. But it is not so hard as you think to find a herd. It is not like looking for just one cow. We have crossed the prairies many times and know them well. And we have also been at the McIvey hammock once before."
"If you say so."
As they turned the horses and rode away, Skillet muttered,
"Now when was them Indian boys ever at Mr. Tobias's place?"
When they reached Tobias, the older boy said, "Tobias McIvey."
"Yes, that's me,"
Tobias replied, wondering also why the boys were out on the prairie. "I am James Tiger, and this is Willie Cypress. We were sent to find you by my grandfather, Keith Tiger."
"Sure, I know Keith Tiger. Haven't seen him for a while now. How is he?"
"Not too good. That is why we are here. The long drought has dried up many ponds and streams, and most of the animals have died or gone away. We have no hides to use in trade. We also have no bullets left for the rifle, and there is little food in our village. My grandfather wishes to buy a few cows from you. He has no money now, but he will pay you as soon as he can."
"I don't care about the pay," Tobias said. "I'm just sorry to hear you're in such a fix. How many cows you want?"
"Just a few to get us by until the animals return. Whatever you can spare."
"How about a dozen? Would that be enough?"
"We did not expect so much," the boy said, surprised by the generous offer. "We were thinking of maybe 4 at the most. A dozen would be more than my people hoped for."
12 cows ain't nothing," Tobias said. "Let's ride over there, and I'll get Skillet and Frog to cut out a dozen of the best ones we got. We had some trouble a few weeks back, and the cows ain't as fat as they ought to be, but they're coming along fine now."
"This will be a real help for my people, and my grandfather will be pleased. But there is one thing you must know. We do not come to you as beggars. My grandfather will repay you for this."
"Don't worry about it. Whatever he does is fine with me."
They followed Tobias over to Skillet, and after he instructed Skillet what to do, Tobias said,
"How long you boys been out here looking for me?"
3 weeks in all, 2 since we left your hammock."
"How you been getting victuals with only them sticks?"
"We have eaten mostly rabbit."
"Then you need some of Emma's cooking. I know how tired a man can get of eating nothing but coons or rabbits. You can stay with us tonight and fill your bellies and then leave in the morning."
Zek rode up and stopped a few feet away, staring curiously at the marsh tackies and the riders. James Tiger looked at Ishmael and said, "Your horse and mine are brothers. The mother is dead now, and the stallion old, but we have others."
"Are you the ones who left Ishmael at the hammock?"
Zek asked. "It was my grandfather, Keith Tiger. But we were with him. Is that the name you gave the horse, Ishmael?"
"Papa named him. I think he got the name from something your granddaddy once told him about the Indians."
I know the word.
James Tiger then asked, Do you still have the wolf dogs?
No, they're both dead. They were shot by bushwhackers who rustled some cows from us. We named them Nip and Tuck. They were the best dogs I ever seen.
I'm sorry to hear that. It is a cruel man who would bushwhack dogs. We will give you others to replace them. This time, they will be leopard dogs.
What's that? Zek asked, his mind bringing forth the vision of a dog shaped like a panther.
They are part hound and part bulldog, and they fear nothing. I have seen two of them kill a bear.
Nip and Tuck could do it, too. They wasn't afraid of anything. They once ran into a whole pack of wolves and tore one's throat open.
Yes, wolf dogs are like that. We have no more of that kind. But you will like the leopards. They are fine dogs, too.
Tobias said, You boys could go on jawing with each other all afternoon. Zek, take them to the wagon and get some smoked beef to hold them till supper.
And tell Emma to pull up at the next stand. We'll go on and stop for the day so she can fix them a whole wash tub of stew.
After supper, Zek and the Indian boys rode across the prairie, talking constantly about horses and dogs and hunting and the great cypress swamp where the Seminoles lived. Even Ishmael seemed to enjoy the company of the other marsh tackies as he pranced lively alongside of them.
Zek said to James Tiger, If you wanted a few cows, how come you didn't just go out on the prairie and round up some instead of coming so far to find us?
We are not allowed to do this, Tiger responded. We are not supposed to even own a cow anymore, and there are men who would do us great harm if we took them off the prairie. They would say we are stealing, although the cows have no marks on them. It is best that we have cows with your mark. That way no one can say that we stole them.
It still don't make sense to me, Zek said. Wild cows are no different from deer. They belong to whoever takes them.
That is not so in our case. Many of our people have been beaten and even hanged for having just one cow. It is dangerous for us to drive your cows back to the swamp, but we have no choice. Our people suffer from hunger and have great need of the meat.
Zek said, I'll ask Papa if I can leave the herd and help you drive the cows to your village. Three of us would be better than two, and nobody would bother us for driving cows with the McIvey mark.
I thank you, but we can manage. Your father would have need of you with such a large herd, and we'll be safe once we reach the south shore of Okeechobee. From there, our people will help us.
When they returned to the camp, Zek lay on his blanket, wide awake, thinking of the things James Tiger told him, wondering why anyone would kill an Indian over a few scrub cows when they were numerous everywhere. He could also not comprehend some people denying the Indians the right to even own a cow. None of it made sense to him, and he felt a deep sympathy for James Tiger and Willie Cypress and all the others who suffered hunger because of what he could only see as gross stupidity and greed. Even the animals were willing to share if it meant survival for all. He was saddened at dawn when the two Seminoles left, and he watched after them until horses and cows disappeared behind a distant cypress stand. He hoped their paths would cross again some day. For four more weeks they stayed on the prairie, going wherever there was grass. Then Tobias rode ahead and purchased cows that were added to the herd. By the time they reached the Caloosahatchee River, the herd numbered over 3,000. The price this time was $12 per cow, and once again a steamer trunk was purchased to carry the sacks of gold doubloons. As Tobias was leaving the store, the clerk called to him,
Mr. McIvey, I almost forgot to mention this. We just got in a shipment from New Orleans that might be of interest to you.
What's that? Tobias asked.
Come on in the storeroom and I'll show you. We haven't even put them out yet.
The clerk took a crowbar and pried open a wooden crate. Then he removed a rifle and handed it to Tobias.
It's the new Winchester repeater, he said. You put the bullets in this magazine under the barrel, and it'll shoot as fast as you pump the lever.
Tobias turned the rifle over in his hands, examining the octagon barrel. Then he sighted it.
How many times will it shoot?
17 bullets per load. Most all the cattlemen who've come in lately have heard about it and asked could we get them in stock. They say rustling and bushwhacking is really getting bad everywhere. One man had 3 drovers killed up south of Arcadia, shot in the back, and a whole herd stole. This rifle ought to could settle a rustler's hash and nothing flat.
I expect it could,
Tobias said, clicking the lever as fast as he could pump it. I just hope the rustlers don't get a hold of these things first. We done had a little taste of bushwhacking ourselves. They killed both our dogs and winged one of my men. How much do the rifles sell for?
$50 each.
That's a mite steep, ain't it?
Well, not really. If you've got a single-shot rifle, owning one of these is like having 17 single-shot guns all loaded and ready to go at once. And you're not paying near as much for this Winchester as you would 17 single-shooters.
I see what you mean. Tobias counted on his fingers, and then he said, I'll take 7 of them.
How many?
7. One for everybody in my crew, including the women. Next time anyone in my bunch gets bushwhacked, we'll make some butts sing with guns like this.
That you will. How much ammunition you want?
How does it come?
24 bullets to a box, 12 boxes to a case.
I'll take 4 cases. That ought to do us for a while, including practice. We'll have to learn how to operate these things. It sure beats my old one-shooter.
I'll have everything ready when you come back with the wagon.
Tobias hesitated for a moment, and then he said, Make that 9 rifles instead of 7, and 2 more cases of bullets. I've got some friends down in Indian country who can make good use of guns like these. You got saddle holsters to fit the Winchesters?
Yes, we have them.
I'll need 5. I'll be back with the wagon in about a half hour and pick all this stuff up. Zek held the rifle proudly, sighting it and then pumping the lever, pulling the trigger and making the hammer click again and again. Tobias watched him for a moment, and then he said, You ought not be doing that, Zek. It's bad on the firing pin. Don't ever pull the trigger on an empty gun.
Can I put some bullets in it?
You better wait till we get out of town. That thing could blow a hole in the dock if you accidentally shot it that way. Let's go on out to camp first and pay everybody off, then you can fire it.
I wouldn't be afraid to face a whole pack of bears with this rifle, Zek said, putting it into the holster. It's the prettiest gun I ever seen. I sure thank you for it, Papa.
You just be careful with it, Tobias cautioned. One of them things can fire as many shots as a whole army squad used to could. It ain't no play toy. You got to handle it like a man.
I will, Papa. I'll be real careful. As soon as we get to the camp, I'll fire off a few rounds and see how it works.
Emma popped the reins and started the oxen, and the men followed her. Skillet held the Winchester in his hands, pretending to shoot from the saddle. As they passed one of the holding pens, Tobias suddenly froze in the saddle. He stopped his horse and gazed intensely at the herd. 3 of the cows closest to him had the mark MCI on their sides. Then he noticed others had the same mark. He shouted, Hold up, Emma! Stop for a minute! Skillet and Zek came to him, and Zek said, What's the matter, Papa?
Look yonder, Tobias said, pointing. Look at the brand on them cows.
It's ourn, Skillet said, puzzled. How come you reckon they in there? We didn't lose no cows out on the prairie for somebody to find.
No, we didn't. Let's see what this is all about.
4 men were standing at the gate, and one of them Tobias recognized as a counter for Captain Hendry. The others he had never seen before. Zek, Skillet, Frog, and Bonzo followed Tobias as Emma looked back from the wagon, perplexed by what was happening. Tobias stopped just short of the huddle of men and said, Who owns this herd?
I do,
one of the men said. He was the same age as Tobias, lanky, too, with a bushy black beard.
How come you want to know?
My name's Tobias McIvey. Captain Hendry knows me well, as do others in Punta Rosa. Some of them cows in there has my mark. Where'd you get them?
Oh, that,
the man said, cautiously eyeing the mounted riders facing him.
Is it the ones with MCI?
That's my brand.
I got a dozen of them. If they're yours, you can have them. I ain't got no use for some other man's cows. I just didn't know who they belonged to.
Where'd you get them? Tobias demanded again.
Took them off some rustlers over near Okeechobee.
What kind of rustlers?
The worst kind? Indians. Them bastards will steal anything they can get their hands on.
Were they men or boys?
Boys. Seems like they're starting real young nowadays.
What did you do to the boys?
Tobias then asked apprehensively.
We hung 'em.
You what?
We hung 'em, the man repeated. That's the only way you can teach Indians a lesson. If you don't, they'll do it over and over again, and there won't be no end to it.
I gave them the cows, Tobias roared, his face crimson red, his hands trembling. They were my cows, and I gave them to them. You killed them boys for nothing.
Zek leaped from his horse and spilled bullets over the ground as he tried desperately to load the rifle, shouting, "I'll kill him, Papa! I'll shoot every one of them!" He was on his knees, snatching bullets from the dust, when Skillet grabbed him and threw him back into the saddle, holding the rifle away from him. Captain Hendry's men started backing away hurriedly, and before any of the men would go for a gun, hammers cocked as Frog and Bonzo aimed Winchesters at them. Tobias said harshly, "You stay out of this, Zek. I'll handle it." "I should have sent someone with the boys, instead of laying them wide open to vultures like these." "What you aim to do?" one of the men asked, backing up against the fence. "How was we to know they didn't steal the cows? They was marked, and we knew it wasn't no mark of an Indian." "I ain't gonna kill you like you done them boys," Tobias said, dismounting, "but I'm gonna make you wish I did." He snatched the whip from his saddlebag and unfurled it. "I'm going to rawhide you bastards till you ain't got one piece of skin left on you. Frog, if one of them tries to run away from it, you and Bonzo shoot him right betwixt the eyes."
"Yes, sir, Mr. McIver, we'll do that."
The whip cracked, and the nearest man fell to the ground, cringing. Then it cracked again and again, spraying the air with cloth fiber mixed with blood. Tobias slashed frantically until finally Skillet grabbed his arm and shouted, "That's enough, Mr. Tobias. If you wants to kill him, do it with a gun, not a whip. They're gone suffer plenty from what you've done already, I know. It remind me of what happened to me. Shoot him, but don't beat him to death." Tobias stopped. His eyes glazed, his heart pounding. Then finally he said, "You're right, Skillet. I done enough. Go in there and cut out our cows. I'll go to the wagon and wait. I don't want to even look at this vermin again." One of the men tried to stand. Then he dropped back to his knees, his shirt and trousers in tatters. He said feebly,
"We'll get you for this, mister. It ain't ended yet."
"You know my name," Tobias said calmly. "It's McIvy. And if you're interested, I live over on the Kissimmee. You're welcome to come to my place any time you want to, but if I ever lay eyes on you again, I'll kill you on sight. That's a promise, not a threat. Just keep that in mind next time you decide to lynch a couple of boys or come looking for me." With that, he mounted and rode to the wagon. Tobias was still trembling with anger as he counted out the coins and handed them to Frog and Bonzo. He said to Skillet, "You want me to leave your share with the rest till we get back to the hammock? That'll be fine. We can split it up then. What are we going to do with these other cows? You want to sell them here or take them back with us?" "Neither. They'll end up where them boys was taking them. I'll drive them myself." Emma was standing nearby, listening, watching Tobias and hoping the anger would subside. She said, "Tobias, you don't even know where the Indians live. How can you hope to find them?" "I know," Tobias said. "Keith Tiger once told me if I ever have need of them to come to the far side of the Okeechobee and head south. They'll find me, not me find them."
"But you don't even know where the lake is," Emma insisted.
"They said it's so big I can't miss it." Emma knew that to argue or reason with him was fruitless, that he was determined to do this thing. She said,
"At least take someone with you."
Tobias turned to Frog and said, "What do you and Bonzo intend to do now? You going to take some time off before going back to the hammock?"
"We'll do whatever you want us to," Frog replied. "Bonzo has been feeling poorly, so we're not going anywhere. When he turns down a drinking spell, you know he ain't up to snuff."
"What's the matter with you?" Tobias said to Bonzo.
"I don't know, Mr. McIvy. Sometimes I feel like my bones is all cracked, and I've been having some sweating spells. But it ain't nothing to worry about. I'll be okay after I rest up a few days."
"Well, you take it easy if you don't feel good. You and Frog best ride on back with the others. I'll take Zek with me."
"I'll go too if you need me," Skillet said.
"No, that ain't necessary. Me and Zek can handle it. And besides, if Bushwhackers is getting as bad as they say, all of you need to stay close to the wagon."
"How long you think you'll be gone?" Emma asked, relieved that he was at least taking Zek with him.
"It ought not take as much as 2 weeks. We'll come straight back after we find the Indians. But I purely dread what I'll have to say to Keith Tiger, if he don't already know."
Chapter 21. Rather than setting out blindly, Tobias decided to go into Punta Raza and talk to Captain Hendry concerning the location of Okeechobee. He was told that the Colusa Hatchie flows from the lake's western shore,
Thus, he could follow the river to its source and then turn south toward the great swamp. From this general description of its location, Tobias figured that on one of their grazing drives they had come to within 20 miles or so of the lake's north shore without knowing it. Captain Hendry also warned him that the land south of the lake was virtually unknown, a wilderness not yet penetrated except by Indians. He thought such a journey as Tobias proposed was foolhardy, but he made no headway in trying to dissuade him. It was early the next morning when Tobias and Zek departed from the others at the ferry landing. Emma said a fearful goodbye, imploring Tobias to abandon the drive and turn back if the trip became too dangerous. Skillet offered once again to go with them, but was refused. The area along the river was heavily wooded, so they moved outward and chose a path parallel to a marsh, giving them more control over the cattle. This time they did not let the cows set the pace, wandering slowly, but grazed them for an hour at a time and then moved forward at a steady pace. Zek noticed that several times during the next 2 days Tobias slumped forward in the saddle, as if in pain, and this perplexed and worried him. Always before, Tobias had been alert and attentive to the cattle, but sometimes now he seemed to drift along aimlessly without giving his horse directions. When Zek rode to him and questioned him, Tobias snapped back to alertness, assuring him that he had merely dozed for a moment because of the intense heat. Once at night, Zek heard him groaning in his sleep, and when he went to him, Tobias was drenched with sweat. On the fourth day, they struck the western shore of Okeechobee, marveling at the seemingly endless expanse of water before them. The shimmering surface stretched into the horizon and gave no hint of a distant shore. Vast areas of blooming pickerel weed lined the water's edge, creating a sea of soft blue that merged gently with clumps of willows and little islands of buttonbush with its creamy white flowers. Nearby rookeries exploded with birds, great blue herons and snowy egrets, white herons and wood ibises, whooping cranes and anhingas with their wings spread outward to dry them. Cormorants dived beneath the surface and popped up unexpectedly 50 feet away, startling flocks of ducks and coots that peppered the surface. Majestic roseate spoonbills stalked up and down the shallows, swishing their long paddle bills from side to side as they raked the bottom in search of food, their pink feathers catching the sunlight and making them appear even pinker. Zek insisted they stop for a day or two and let the cattle graze on the abundant grass, but he was more interested in rest for his father than food for the cows. Tobias agreed reluctantly, wanting to push on immediately, but in his weakened condition, he allowed himself to be overruled. After making camp beneath a thick covering of alders, they walked back to the shore and watched the unfamiliar sights with fascination, seeing an endless parade of nature's creatures. Willows were so loaded with chattering red-winged blackbirds that it seemed the tree limbs would surely break, and fish were so plentiful their fins cut the calm surface with constant ripples. Zek took his fishing line from the saddlebag, cut a cane pole, and caught crickets for bait, and in only moments he caught more black bass and catfish than they could hope to eat. On the way back to the camp, he gathered figs from a thick grove of wild trees, and for supper they had fish roasted over an open fire, followed by the sugary fruit. That night, the eerie call of limpkins blended with the croaking of bullfrogs and the grunting of alligators, forming a strange type of music never heard out on the prairie. Tobias moved closer to the warming fire and said, "I'm glad we stopped here, Zek. I've never seen a place so full of life. Not even back in the scrub. I can see now why some of the Indians they ran off from here hid in the swamps, hoping to come back someday. I hope they can, but I got a notion they won't. When folks find out what's here, they'll take it over. And you won't ever again see an Indian on this lake's shore. Maybe someday we can come back and see it all. I sure hope so. James Tiger told me there can be waves out there taller than a man. And at some places there's sand dunes like at the ocean. He also told me that the sun sucks water from the lake, and it'll drop down several inches during the day, and then during the night it'll come right back to where it was. I'd sure like to see that, too." "Maybe someday," Tobias said again,
but right now I think I'll sleep. I feel kind of tired all through and through, like a wore-out old ox.
You ain't old at all, Papa, but you get some rest. I'll stay up tonight and take care of the cows.
2 days stretched into three, and Tobias gained strength from the fresh fish, wild fruits, and berries. On the morning of the third day, they broke camp and continued the drive, skirting the rim of the lake, but when they rounded the western shore and attempted to head directly south, they were met by a stretch of sawgrass with blades so sharp it prohibited the entrance of cows, men, and horses. At this point, they turned to the southwest and entered a custard apple forest, a jungle unlike anything they had ever encountered. Trees were so dense, they formed a barrier almost as impenetrable as the sawgrass. The sky was blocked out immediately by leafy branches completely covered by a solid blanket of moon vines, turning a bright noonday sun to dim twilight. The cows walked single file to make their way through the wall of trunks, and there was no way to drive them in a straight line. They skirted masses of dead limbs long since blown down by hurricanes, and gourd vines, looping from branch to branch, formed a curtain of green fruit. Trees were peppered with air plants that blossomed with brilliant red and orange flowers, and the ground beneath was totally bare except for lush beds of ferns, some ground level and others as tall as the horses. The forest also teemed with Carolina parakeets as numerous as were the blackbirds at the lake, and low-hanging limbs were anchored to the ground by giant spider webs. Once, Zek threw a stick into one of the webs in a useless attempt to break through. It sang like violin strings and held fast, causing the huge brown and yellow spiders to rush forward and examine the captured missile. Every foot of the way was blocked by something. Trunks, tangling vines, webs, grotesque outcroppings of roots. They turned, zigzagged, and backtracked, popping the whips and cursing the bewildered cows, moving tortuously through an atmosphere so murky they couldn't determine if they were heading south or north. And in 1 4-hour stretch, they traveled less than a mile. There was no sunset that afternoon beneath the solid roof of the jungle, only a fleeting moment when twilight turned to instant darkness. Zek built a fire, and they huddled together, hearing the chilling cry of sentinel hawks and the mournful song of whippoorwills. Screech owls then joined the chorus, making the cows also come together in a tight circle. Zek suggested time and again they turn back and seek another way, but each time Tobias shook his head in disagreement. It was impossible to tell when dawn came, and when finally a dim yellow light drifted down through the vines, it could as well have been noon as mid-morning. They moved again, repeating the experience of the previous day, turning, twisting, and probing mile after mile of the same frustration. Even Tobias now worried about the cows and horses, since there was nothing for them to eat but ferns. He hoped the lazy outgrowths were not poisonous. Another night was spent beneath the canopy, then another morning vainly searching for an escape route. Just when they both became resigned to the fact they were hopelessly trapped, they broke free at mid-afternoon and entered a marsh. The cows and horses grazed ravenously, and Tobias agreed to stop for the night. After building a fire, Zek walked back to the edge of the forest. He stepped gingerly onto the moon vines and jumped up and down, finding the green carpet to be as solid as a bed. Then he walked upward, slowly, a step at a time, until he reached the top of the trees and stood on the jungle's roof. The vines stretched away as far as he could see, like a verdant plain splotched with blooming white flowers. He walked forward, at first cautiously and then with confidence, traveling 100 yards before turning back reluctantly, wishing he could retrace the entire distance they had come, but knowing he should return to Tobias. As he made his way down the leafy incline and onto solid ground again, he trembled with excitement, feeling he now had a newfound secret not to be shared, like a baby eagle no longer earthbound, drunk with the exhilaration of its first flight. The thrill of the experience carried over past supper and into the night, and as they moved away at dawn,
Zek looked back with both fear and joy at the giant tent nature had created over the forest. The marsh dissipated rapidly, and then they came to the edge of the place they were seeking, the Great Cypress Swamp. At first the land was peppered with small dwarf cypress and pond cypress. Then suddenly there loomed before them the mighty virgin bald cypress trees themselves, reaching up to 150 feet into the air, some with bases 70 feet in circumference. Cypress knees sprang up all around the base of the trees, like giant mushrooms, some shaped like deformed human heads, some like birds, others like small animals, creating a wooden menagerie. Wild orchids clung to every limb, turning the somber trees into color bursts of yellow and white and green and purple. There were also gumbo limbo trees, lance woods, cocoa plum bushes, oaks festooned with Spanish moss, and the awesome magnolias with leaf-covered limbs reaching 60 feet outward and then downward to the ground, like a mother hen protecting her brood with a covering of wing feathers. Piercing all of it were royal palms whose bare trunks towered above some of the bald cypress, forming little umbrellas of fronds high in the sky. At first, they stopped and stared incredulously, comparing the giant bald cypress to the little matchsticks that formed cypress stands on the prairie. Then they moved forward again. The ground was dry, but they could see water marks several inches up the cypress knees where water normally reached. They passed easily over dry sloughs that once would have to be forded and skirted around ponds covered solidly with lily pads and green slime. Cottonmouth moccasins scurried away beneath the surface and left trail marks, and the snouts of alligators poked upward like dead logs, their eyes open and blank as the intruders passed by. They were also greeted by hordes of mosquitoes, not a solid mass like the cloud at the salt marsh, but a constant annoyance. Zek and Tobias both slapped and scratched, wondering how the Indians who lived here could stand it. They could see areas on the bases of the trees where panthers scratched the bark to shreds, sharpening their claws, and the horses stepped around holes rooted out by wild hogs searching for food. The deeper they penetrated the swamp, the thicker became the trees and other foliage, until finally they faced obstacles almost as formidable as the custard apple forest. Once again they zigzagged and backtracked, searching for open paths, having difficulty controlling the cows. Zek was doubly worried, wondering if there was no end to this alien land, and also noticing Tobias slumping forward in the saddle, sweat pouring from his face and staining his shirt. He did not believe there was even a bare possibility of finding the Indian village in such an overwhelming swamp, that to continue was foolish and useless. But Tobias would not relent and turn back. For 2 days they passed no pond or stream where the water looked drinkable, and at night they rationed themselves to 1 cup from the canteens. Supper was limited to a thin twist of dried beef and rock-hard biscuit. On the third night in the swamp, they were sitting by a fire, hoping the smoke would drive away the mosquitoes, when a man stepped from the shadows and confronted them. He was dressed in a multicolored shirt that came down to his knees, deerskin trousers, moccasins, deerskin leggings, and a crossed finger-woven sash with long fringes. From his neck downward over his chest hung a gorget fashioned from silver coins hammered thin, and on his head he wore a turban crowned by an egret plume. Both Zek and Tobias were startled, and both scrambled to their feet as the man said, "Do not be frightened. I bear no arms, not even a spear. We have known you are coming this way since you left the custard apple forest." Tobias calmed himself, and then he said, "My name is Tobias McIvey, and this is my son Zek. We're looking for the village of Keith Tiger. I am Tony Cypress, father of Willie Cypress. We know who you are. I will come back at daybreak and lead you to the village. Your cattle would become lost in the darkness if you followed me now." "How do you know who I am?" Tobias questioned, puzzled. "We trust no one, and we watch intruders. You were described today to Keith Tiger, and he said it would be Tobias McIvey. He does not understand why you drive cattle into the swamp.
Do you know what has happened to your son and James Tiger?
Tobias asked cautiously.
They were sent to find you on Baikal, but they have not returned. We sent runners searching for them as far as the south shore of Okeechobee, but did not find them. Do you have news of them?
Tobias dared not tell of the hanging to Tony Cypress alone, fearing the reaction. He would feel safer telling the news to a friend. He said,
"We have seen them, and we can talk of this tomorrow with you and Keith Tiger. There's no need to discuss it now."
"Do you have food?"
"Not much, but enough to do us for now.
I will return at daybreak. Watch your cows closely. Since the deer are scarce, the panthers are hungry and will attack anything. Do not let your fire go out."
The Indian then stepped backward and disappeared into the darkness.
Zek threw more sticks onto the fire and watched as a stream of sparks drifted upward, glowing briefly like fireflies. Then he took the Winchester from his saddle holster and placed it beside his blanket. He said, "Papa, what are we going to do if they blame us for what happened to James and Willie?"
"I've been thinking about that, too. Fact is, I thought about it all the way down here, and I don't have an answer yet. I just don't really know. We'll have to wait and see what happens. If I were Tony Cypress, and it was you hung instead of Willie, I'm not sure myself what I'd do."
There were a dozen chickies in the village, small, open-sided huts constructed of cypress poles with roofs of thatched palmetto fronds and bear grass. Beneath one, a black cooking pot was tended by an old woman, stirring constantly with a wooden paddle. All of the men were dressed similar to Tony Cypress, and the women wore multicolored ankle-length dresses with a dozen strands of glass beads around their necks. On top of each one's head was a tight ball of hair held fast by black netting. At the fringe of the clearing there were several clumps of banana trees and a small garden plot containing wilted tomato plants, okra, squash, and corn that had turned brown prematurely from lack of rain. Everyone in the village watched curiously as the cows invaded the clearing and milled about. Tobias and Zek rode in and dismounted, and then followed Tony Cypress to one of the chickies. Keith Tiger was sitting on the ground, and when he looked up and recognized the visitors, he motioned for them to sit with him. He looked older than Tobias remembered, and his hair was now completely white. Tobias said, "It's good to see you again, Keith Tiger."
"And you too, Tobias,"
he answered, a smile creasing his face.
"I am told by Tony Cypress that you bring news of my grandson and Willie Cypress."
"Yes, I do, but first there are other things," Tobias said, wanting to delay the inevitable as long as possible.
"The cattle are for your people, and we have brought gifts. Go and get them, Zek."
Zek went to the horses and returned in a moment, placing boxes on the ground and handing two rifles to Tobias. He passed them on to Keith Tiger and said,
"These are Winchester repeaters, a rifle that shoots 17 times in one load. We also brought two cases of bullets, enough to last you for a long time."
Tiger examined one of the rifles and passed the other to Tony Cypress.
"I have never seen such as this," he said.
"How does it work?"
"You just put the bullets in the magazine under the barrel, and when you pull the lever, a bullet goes into the chamber. It shoots as fast as you pump the lever till all the bullets are gone. It'll bring down a deer easily at 100 yards and more."
Tiger stroked the stock with his hand, saying,
"This will be a great help to us, and I thank you, Tobias. The bow and arrow is almost useless in the swamp. You shoot at a deer and hit vines or trees instead. It is not like hunting on the open prairie. For here we need guns and bullets. This weapon will provide much food."
"Maybe you can shoot skeeters with it, too," Tobias said jokingly, pleased by the reaction to the gift.
"I don't see how you folks stand it all the time." "We have grown used to them," Tiger responded. "There are many things we have been forced to learn since hiding here in the swamp. When our people lived on the land that is now Tallahassee, the soil there grew corn and beans and squash and pumpkins in abundance. Here things do not grow so well. It is the same with hunting.
When there is no rain, the swamp dries up and animals go elsewhere. And when there is great rain, it floods, also driving them away or drowning them. There is always something facing us we must overcome. It has been difficult, but we have survived. But tell me now, why is it that you drive in the cattle instead of James and Willie? What is your news of them?
Tobias knew he could delay no longer. He spoke slowly, recounting the chain of events in his mind.
They found us on a prairie north of the Caloosahatchee and explained their mission. They spent the night in our camp and left at daybreak the next morning. Zek offered to ride with them and help drive the cattle, but was refused. They said they could handle it alone. And that was the last we saw them. It was several weeks before we reached Punta Rasa with the herd. As we left the village, I saw cows with my mark on them in another man's herd. I questioned him about this, and he said he took them from rustlers down close to Okeechobee. Then a tiger broke in and asked anxiously, "If someone stole the cattle from James and Willie, why did they not return here and tell us of this? Where are they now?" I asked them who the rustlers were. Tobias responded hesitantly, and they told me it was two Indian boys. Then I asked what happened to the boys, and the man who owned the herd told me they hung them. They're dead, Keith. I told the men that I had given the cows to the boys and that they had hung them for no reason. Then I beat all of them with my whip, beat them almost to death. I'm real sorry to have to tell you this. Real sorry. I don't know what else to say.
Both Indian men sat stunned, mentally frozen, trying to accept the finality of the words. Keith Tiger's eyes misted as he said, "In my heart I feared this. But it hurts no less hearing it from you now. I hoped that somehow they would return. This is the end for me. They killed my son in the last war, and now my grandson. James was the only one left, and now there is no one to carry on my name. It is ended forever. It would be better if they would come and kill me also. I have no reason now to live." Tony Cypress said angrily, "Do you know where the men live who did this thing? If you do, we will find them and kill them."
I was so mad I didn't even ask their names, Tobias responded. After I beat them with the whip, they threatened to come after me later. They know where I live, and if they ever come to my place, I'll kill them myself. This I promise. I hope you don't blame me for what happened. If I had known, I would have."
Tobias's voice trailed off, and he never finished. He stood up suddenly, staggered a few steps, and fell. Zek rushed to him. He shook him and said, "Papa, Papa, what is it? What's the matter?" Tobias shivered as if cold, and sweat poured from his face. He tried to speak, but couldn't. Then his glazed eyes locked onto Zek's, begging for help. Zek brushed sweat from his father's forehead. Then he looked to Keith Tiger. "Oh, Lord, somebody do something!" Keith Tiger said, "When you came into the Chickie, I thought Tobias looked ill. How long has he been this way?"
"Ever since we left Punta Rasa. I begged him to turn back, but he wouldn't. He wanted to bring you the cows. Can you help him? Do you know what's wrong?"
Tiger put his hand on Tobias's forehead. "It is malaria. We have seen it many times." Then he turned to Tony Cypress. "Get the medicine man and tell Lily to bring blankets quickly. He is very sick."
"Don't let him die," Zek pleaded fearfully. "If I had known he was this sick, I would have tied him with ropes and taken him home. Mama could nurse him."
"Do not blame yourself for this,"
Tiger said, putting his arm around Zek, trying to calm him.
It would have happened no matter where he was. It is best he is here. The medicine man can help him more than anyone. He knows what to do. We will do all we can to save him.
The medicine man was in his 50s, tall and lean, with gray hair that came down to his shoulders. He wore a knee-length dress only, and around his neck there hung a deerskin pouch, the sacred medicine bag, a symbol of his power. Zek watched constantly, hovering, asking questions that were ignored, becoming a nuisance, told time and again to move away, but refusing to do so. A bubbling pot sat next to the chicky, brewing a deep red liquid made of roots and herbs and the bark of a gumbo limbo tree. Lily held the blankets tight around Tobias as the medicine man lifted him up and forced the brew down his throat. Then they packed his forehead with lily pads made cool with pond muck. For a day and a night, Zek circled the chicky like a wolf stalking a herd, until finally Keith Tiger came to him and said, "There is no need for you to do this. It will not help. And soon we will have two sick men instead of one. Go and get food and rest. Leave your father to the medicine man and Lily. If there is a change, we will tell you." The old woman in the cooking chickie gave Zek a gourd bowl of softki. He went to the far side of the clearing and sat on a log alone, absently chewing the hot gruel. He was not aware that someone was beside him, until she said, "Don't fret so. They will make your father well again. The medicine man has great power." Zek put the bowl down and said, "I'm sorry. I didn't know you were here." The girl was 16, slim and firm, with black hair that swirled down to her hips. She had a thin mouth, high cheekbones, and oriental eyes, the look of pure Seminole. She said, "I am Tawanda Cypress. Willie was my brother." Zek flushed with guilt when she said it, feeling uneasy, as if accused without the words being spoken. He said, "I'm sorry. I offered to ride with them, but they wouldn't let me. If I had gone anyway, he would be here now." "You don't know this to be true. It's possible they would have killed you too, just for being with James and Willie. I don't judge you as I judge those men who did such a terrible thing." Zek looked at her closer, noticing she was very pretty. Something was different about her, something he could not at once place. And then he realized what it was. He said, "The night James and Willie spent in our camp, we rode the prairie together, and they told me many things about life here. You don't speak like they did or the others." She smiled. "Does it show so much? I spent 3 months with a missionary and his wife, who are camped west of here, near the 10,000 Islands. They were teaching me to read and write, and I suppose I took up some of their way of speaking. My father says someone among us should learn to write the white man's language, that it could be helpful someday, and he sent me there. They also instructed me in the Christian way, but I'm confused about that. I cannot understand why Christians kill for cattle." "I can't answer that for you," Zek said. "I don't understand it myself. But not all white people are Christians, and not all white men will kill for a cow. My papa would never do it, and I wouldn't either. Papa almost beat those men to death for what they did, and I would have shot them for sure if Skillet hadn't grabbed me and taken my rifle." "Can you read and write?"
"No. I've never had learning. Mama can do it some, but Papa can't. There's no time or use for such things on cattle drives. All you need to know is how to count heads and money."
"I'll go back soon and stay a while longer. Maybe someday I'll be able to teach you. Then we'll both know how."
"How come you're not afraid to stay with strangers?"
"I was at first, but they're very kind people, and they would never harm me. Their camp is also well hidden from others. Father came on it one day while hunting and became friends."
"I guess I ought to go back now and see about Papa," Zek said, starting to get up.
"You love him very much, don't you?"
"Yes. We've done things together ever since I can remember. We've seen some bad times, and he brought us through it. I don't know what me and Mama would do without him."
You can't help him now by getting in the way of the medicine man and Lily. Let them do what they must do. Stay here with me for a while longer. I enjoy talking to you.
I suppose you're right, Zek agreed, but I can't help it. If we were at the house now, Mama would run me out with a broom. But I've never seen Papa sick like this. It scares me.
Would you like to see the Great Marsh? She asked, trying to steer his mind to something besides Tobias. I can show it to you.
Is that the place James and Willie told me about? They said there's nothing else like it?
Yes. We call it Peheoki, the River of Grass. It would be a shame for you not to see it while you're here. If we leave now, there is time to go there and return before nightfall. I know the way well.
Then let's do it. I'll stay out of the way for the rest of the afternoon. I think the medicine man wanted to put me in the cooking pot with that stuff he's brewing.
They walked to where Ishmael was tied, and when Zek picked up the saddle, she said, "We don't need that. It's better without it."
"I'll put you on first and get on behind you," Zek said, throwing aside the saddle.
"An Indian woman would never do such a thing," Tawanda said teasingly. "We ride behind the man, not in front."
"If that's the way you want it, it's fine with me."
Zek leaped onto the horse. Then he took her hand and pulled her up behind him. As they started out of the clearing, she locked her arms around him, pulling as close as possible. He could feel her pressing against him, her body moving in perfect rhythm with his as Ishmael walked in a steady gait. The female smell of her made him dizzy. Like the night he rode with Glenda, only this time the scent was not flowers. It was an outdoor smell, like smoke and crushed pine needles. Zek followed her directions, and they rode deeper and deeper into the swamp, skirting islands of ferns taller than Ishmael, passing through myriad knees surrounding the giant trees. When finally they came to a narrow stream, she said, "Stop here and tie the horse. We will go on in the canoe." On the bank, there was a long, dug-out cypress canoe and two thin poles. They pushed the canoe into the water. Then Zek stood in front and Tawanda in the rear, and they poled the slim craft down the creek. At first it was tricky for Zek, and he almost lost his balance. Tawanda laughed at him until finally he gained confidence and pushed the canoe with ease. The stream twisted and turned, sometimes just wide enough for the canoe to pass, and several times it led into small ponds covered with lily pads where turtles and alligators moved away as they glided by. Then suddenly the swamp ended, as if a line had been drawn to separate swamp from marsh, and looming before them was Peheoki, a land so overwhelming in its vastness it caused Zek to blink his eyes in wonderment. Sawgrass stretched into infinity, broken only by small island hammocks of hardwood trees and cabbage palms. Flights of egrets and herons drifted for miles, dwarfing what Zek had seen at Okeechobee or elsewhere. He continued staring as Tawanda said, "You're one of the few people to ever see this besides an Indian. What do you think of it?" "It seems like the whole world out there. How far does it go?" "To the sea in the south. It is many days' journey from here to the end of it, and it is very difficult pushing the canoe through the sawgrass. Sometimes the grass is taller than two men. When our people make the journey, they push down the grass and sleep on it at night, and sometimes snakes crawl in with you. There are also many alligators out there, and crocodiles, too."
"I'd like to cross it someday," Zek said. "Would you go with me and show me the way?"
"I would if you asked, but it is not a good place for women. We'll go a bit further now, then we should turn back."
As they poled the canoe, Zek watched with interest as an Everglades kite glided over them, its huge wings extended, moving so slowly it seemed to be suspended in midair. Then a flight of small birds swooped in and harassed it, diving and pecking until finally the kite shot downward into the sawgrass and disappeared. The canoe sliced like a knife through the dense grass, and when Zek reached out and touched it with curiosity, blood oozed from cuts on his hand.
They circled one small island and then returned to the creek. When they reached the place where Ishmael was tied, they pulled the canoe back onto the bank. Zek said, "I'm glad you brought me here, Tawanda. I'll always remember this place." As he untied Ishmael, they brushed together, and on an impulse his arms went around her, holding her close. Then he pressed his mouth to hers. She went limp, and without him, she would have fallen to the ground. Zek's breath came in gasps as he continued holding her, feeling his heart pound harder than hers. Every cell in his body tingled as he was flooded with a sensation that overwhelmed him, blocking out everything but Tawanda's presence. Time stopped, and when finally he released her, he said softly, "I'm sorry. I've never done this with a girl before. It just happened before I knew it." "Why are you sorry?" she asked, looking into his eyes. "Is it because I am an Indian? Does it shame you to be with me?" "No," he said quickly. "It's not that at all. I thought you'd be angry." "Do it once more, and let's see if it makes me angry." He kissed her again, this time longer, forgetting to breathe or let her breathe, and when he broke away, they were both panting. "You see, I'm not angry," she said. "I will stay here with you as long as you wish. We can find our way back when night comes." He pressed her close again, his body aching for her, feeling actual pain, wanting to experience something he had only dreamed about. He would lie with her in a bed of ferns or even in an eagle's nest high up a cypress tree if that was what she wanted. As he held her, it seemed he had known her always, not just this one afternoon, that loving her now would be as natural as a full moon or rain in spring. He took her hands in his and said, "I've never known anything like this, Tawanda. I want to stay here and be with you real bad, more than anything. But we better go now. I need to see about Papa." "I thought so," she said without anger. "But it doesn't matter. There will be other times for us." "Are you mad at me?" "No. I know your feeling. I cried all night when your father told the news of my brother. You are crying inside now, and I know this. We can come into the woods again tomorrow, or whenever you wish. All you have to do is ask, and I will go with you." He mounted Ishmael and lifted her behind him, and as they rode back, she pressed against him, her face on his shoulder, her hands burning his chest like a branding iron. The sun sank rapidly as they approached the village, and already nighthawks swooped about, zigzagging crazily as they chased mosquitoes. No one seemed to notice as they rode in and dismounted, Zek holding her longer than necessary when her feet touched the ground. She followed him to the chickie and stood beside him as he looked down at his father. There was no change in Tobias. The medicine man and Lily still hovered over him, paying no heed to Zek and Tawanda. Zek knew it would be useless to question them, so he turned and walked away. One of the cows had been slaughtered while they were gone, and the smell of roasted beef drifted from the cooking chickie. Tawanda prepared two wooden plates for them. Then Zek followed her to the edge of the clearing. They sat on the ground just at the point where fire shadows faded into darkness, eating silently. Tawanda then said, "We're breaking a Seminole rule already. An Indian woman does not sit beside her man while eating." "Where I come from, they do," Zek replied. "My mama and papa do everything together. It'll be the same with us." He surprised himself with the statement, as if they already belonged to each other. But it did not bother him. All of the awkwardness of their first meeting was gone, and he felt as comfortable with her as he did with Ishmael. "There are many things in your world I don't know," she said. "I am Indian, and we are different from you. I'm not sure I could ever adjust." "You wouldn't have to. I live in the woods, too.
We hunt cattle, then we graze them, and after we sell them, we go back to the woods and start over again. What's so different about that?
But there are white people who would scorn you for being seen with an Indian.
That don't bother me either. I don't care what somebody thinks.
Tawanda got up suddenly and said, I'd better go to the Chiki now before my father comes looking for me. It is also against an Indian rule for me to sit here with you in the darkness. In the morning, I'll cook something special for you to eat. He sat by himself and watched as she walked away. Then he took his blanket and placed it beside the Chiki, where his father tossed restlessly. The medicine man was gone, but Lily was still there, changing the pads that cooled Tobias's face. He lay on his blanket and stared upward into the trees, thinking of the contrast between the only two girls he had ever known. Glenda's skin was white and creamy, Tawanda's brown and firm. Glenda smelled like flowers, Tawanda like smoke and crushed pine needles. One rode a horse side saddle, the other like a man. Guilt suddenly flushed through him, guilt that he had enjoyed himself so much being with Tawanda while his father lay gravely ill. He should have been at his father's side, not out in the woods with Tawanda. If he had accepted her invitation, he would probably still be there with her at a time when his father could be dying. His thoughts plagued him until finally he fell asleep. The next morning, Tawanda fixed a breakfast of Kunti biscuits and fried beef strips, and he ate eagerly. She watched him expectantly, hoping he would again take her away on Ishmael. But he returned to the Chiki and sat by his father, ignoring her. She understood and said nothing. At noon, the fever broke, and Tobias sat up and sipped a cup of beef broth. He smiled at Zek. Then he lay back down and drifted into a calm sleep. Zek's spirit soared as Keith Tiger said to him, Tobias will be fine now. He has passed the worst of it. In a few days you will be able to take him home. I know your people are worried. The words caused Zek a new concern that had not come into his mind while Tobias was so ill. His mother would be frantic with worry if they did not return soon. There was no way anyone from the hammock could ever find them here in this small village in the great cypress swamp. He continued hovering about the Chiki, again making a nuisance of himself, until finally Lily spoke the only words she said in 3 days.
Go away and let us take care of him. You are worse than a puppy trying to get at its mother's tits.
He left reluctantly and went into the woods with Tawanda. They held hands as they walked together silently, communicating without speaking. She did not offer herself again, letting him take the lead, understanding his concern for his father overshadowed all else. This was the Indian way also, and she accepted it without hurt or anger. When they returned to the camp, they stayed together constantly, sitting beside the Chiki with Tobias, dipping food from the cooking pot, leading Ishmael to a plot of abundant grass. It did not cross Zek's mind that this togetherness would be an oddity to the other Indians, and he did not notice the curious glances that came his way, even from Tawanda's mother and father. And it did not seem to cause Tawanda concern. Tobias gradually gained strength, getting up and walking a few steps at a time, then eating solid food. He had become even more gaunt, and his clothes hung on him like sacks. On the morning of the 6th day, he said to Zek, How long have we been here? I don't remember much since the day we arrived.
Almost a week, Papa.
A week? Good Lord. Emma would be worried sick. We'll have to leave in the morning.
Are you sure you're strong enough to ride, Papa? I could go to the hammock and tell them you're fine and let you stay here and rest. Then I would come back for you. I couldn't leave while you were so sick.
No, I'll be fine. We'll go back together. Keith Tiger spoke up. You're welcome to stay here as long as you wish, Tobias. But if you leave, you must ride easy and not push yourself. See if you can find quinine at a trading post. It is what the soldiers use for malaria.
I'll do that. And I truly thank you for what you've done for me.
It is we who owe you thanks. The cows and rifles will save our people. Is there anything you wish from us in return?
My life is enough. But there's something Zek wanted, if you can spare it. Dogs. Some rustlers killed the wolf dogs you gave us.
That is no problem. We have puppies, and you can take your pick.
No, Zek said quickly. James promised me some dogs he called leopards, but if I took them now, they'd remind me of him and Willie. I couldn't stand it. I don't want dogs.
I understand, Keith Tiger said. It will be as you wish.
I thank you just the same, Zek said more calmly, not wanting the Indian to think he didn't appreciate the offer.
What's the name of the medicine man who tended me? Tobias asked. I haven't thanked him yet.
His name is Miami Billy, Tiger responded. He is out gathering roots and bark to make medicine for you to take with you on the trip home. He will return soon. Tonight, we will have a celebration of your recovery, Tobias. We will roast the tail of an alligator. This afternoon, I will test the Winchester against the gator's hard skull. You will enjoy the feast.
All of the Indians were in a festive mood as the huge chunk of meat roasted on a spit over the fire. Zek and Tawanda again isolated themselves from the others and ate together, and the alligator was as good to Zek as the first chicken he tasted in Punta Rasa. Tobias was tired and went to bed immediately after eating. And soon the village became quiet as everyone drifted into the chickies. Zek was almost asleep when Tawanda came silently and lay down beside him. He put his arms around her, absorbing her warmth. She pressed closer, facing him, and sleep came imperceptibly as they clung together. Neither of them were aware when her father came from the shadows and looked at them briefly, seeing them asleep together like children, then turning and going away. The next morning, as they were exchanging final goodbyes, Keith Tiger said to Tobias, "Do not go back the way you came. It is too difficult in the custard apple forest. Go to the east side of Okeechobee, near the ocean. There are pine lands there and open prairie. It will be easier for you." Tobias mounted the horse shakily and steadied himself, still weak but determined to ride. Zek and Tawanda shared intimate glances, their eyes meeting in a silent understanding that he would return. But no tears came to her eyes. To cry at parting would not be the way of an Indian woman. They looked back and waved as they entered the woods, and the sight of Tawanda became etched in Zek's mind. She looked small and alone as the early sunlight caught in her raven hair. Tobias turned to Zek and said, "I woke up during the night and saw you sleeping with that girl. Did you do anything to her?" Zek blushed, and he stammered as he said, "No, Papa, I didn't do anything. We just slept together, that's all."
"You're old enough to plant seeds now, Zek, and you got to be careful. Those people are our friends, and it wouldn't be right for you to ride off and leave something in that girl's belly. Are you sure you didn't do nothing?"
"Yes, Papa, I'm sure. We didn't do nothing but sleep. We became friends while you were so sick, that's all."
Tobias stopped the horse momentarily and turned to Zek.
"I don't have any objections to whatever you did, Zek. And I believe you if you say you didn't do anything with her. I wouldn't mind if you brought an Indian girl home with you for good, and Emma wouldn't either. That's not the point. Just don't ever mess up a girl and then go off and leave her to fend for herself. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"I understand, Papa. I wouldn't do anything to hurt Tawanda. Not ever."
"I know it ain't natural for you to grow up in the wilderness without no young people around, especially girls. Heck, time I was your age, I'd done had a few romps in a cotton patch, and I guess I was just lucky, 'cause nothing came of it. Just don't go hog wild first chance you get to lie with a girl. It ain't that simple. But if you like her, don't let nothing stand in your way. I would have waded through hellfire to make your mama mine, and you'll do the same when the time comes."
Then he snapped the reins and said, "Let's ride now. We got a long way to go." They moved slowly, stopping often to let Tobias rest and sip the medicine Miami Billy gave him, and when they rounded the east shore of Okeechobee, it was, as Keith Tiger said, pine scrub and palmetto prairie. Days stretched into a week, and soon they came to the marsh where the herd drowned on their first grazing drive. From here they turned northwest, going out of the way toward the trading post at Fort Drum to see if Tobias could purchase quinine.